If you grew up as a kid in New York City, or for that matter, if your parents or somebody took you to New York City when you were a kid, inevitably you went to the American Museum of Natural History, and inevitably what impressed you most were the dioramas of Carl Akeley and the Africa Hall. Why do I mention that as we begin? Because Carl Akeley is our subject tonight, because Jay Kirk has just done a fascinating biography of the man, and more broadly of the whole world in which he moved and which he influenced. That is titled Kingdom Under Glass. And interestingly, I note to Jay Kirk, we see one significant man-like figure on the cover, but it's not a man, it's an ape, a gorilla, pounding his chest. Why?
Why is he pounding his chest?
Why is he on the cover? Yeah.
Well, that's actually one of Akeley's dioramas, probably his most famous actual diorama, probably the most famous creation of his that's in the African Hall in New York are the elephants in the center, which is the centerpiece of the hall, but they are not, they're not exactly the same because they're not behind glass, I guess. Of course, they're not a complete
They stand right in
diorama.
The middle of the hall, and they're sort of coming down upon you.
Right, right, right. It's actually called the alarm, and if you look, mm-hmm. you'll see that they're rather very anxious looking, and the rear guard elephant in the back is turned with a great look of apprehension, and so.
It was a fascinating place to visit when I was a kid, probably 7 or 8 years old. I don't remember, but an elementary school class was taken on a visit to the American Museum of Natural History, and that was, of course, the most memorable portion of the visit.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I feel the same way when I went there as a kid. My grandparents grew up on Long Island. Yeah. I grew up in Vermont, and my mom always made a point of taking us through there. And that, I mean, all of the dioramas to me stuck out in my memory. I'm just like that suspension of disbelief. They're remarkable. In a way, they're more fun than going to the movies.
You define Akeley, among other things, as sort of the leading taxidermist of the Western world. And the man who really reorganized taxidermy as an art.
There's no question that Carl Akeley is the greatest taxidermist who ever lived. His boss at the museum, Henry Fairfield Osborne, actually compared Akeley in talent to Phidias, that great sculptor from ancient Greece who created images of Athena for the Parthenon and Zeus. I mean, he completely revolutionized the form. When he started out as a young boy doing taxidermy, it hadn't really progressed all that much since it had been invented. And then by the time he was an apprentice for the great museum preparators who worked for these new up-and-coming natural history museums, he found himself to be greatly disappointed at the art, or the lack of art, that was involved in the making of taxidermy. Because they would basically just create a mannequin, an armature of the animal, and use its leg bones and its skull attached to a metal rod, and then stuff it with whatever they had. I mean, they'd use old rags or sawdust or whatever was laying around the workshop, and Akeley thought, no, we can do better than this.
What was his innovation?
Well, his first real innovation was bothering to learn anatomy. And so he became a sculptor. He used clay. Now, occasionally, the taxidermists would use clay to rough out the dimensions of an armature. But Akeley went all the way, and he really had a real artistic talent. I mean, I think he was a genius. And you look at some of the armatures that he would complete, he created them with, after taking countless measurements of the actual animal first, with calipers and tape measures, endless sketches, just to get everything right. He wanted it to look exactly like the animal looked like in real life. And I think that was why it ended up being so important for him to go to Africa on all of these expeditions, so that he could really observe the animals himself and see how they lived.
I gather from what you say in the book and what you just said a moment ago that the high art of taxidermy develops concurrently with a certain kind of expansion in museums. Museums of natural history, as they develop, sort of foster and require improvements in taxidermy.
Yeah, and I think that the other thing that went along with it, and Akeley had a great hand in this too, being the inventor of the so-called habitat diorama, which paralleled the advent of the theory of ecology, which is that an animal doesn't just exist on its own in a vacuum in a glass box with a couple of leaves scattered on the ground. It's intimately connected to its environment. So the dioramas, these habitat dioramas that Akeley started making, you will see the same degree of verisimilitude and reconstruction of the leaves, right down to the leaves. And he wanted to get that just right, just as much as he wanted to get the actual animals right.
I imagine no one told you that I, your interviewer in real life, am or have been an academically based psychologist. I mention that right now because years ago, a woman in the psychology department at Harvard, Anne Rowe by name, started a series of studies in which the basic question she was asking was, what kinds of personalities go with skill in different kinds of professions? And she studied a number of professions and people who were especially prominent in those professions and those who sort of failed at those professions to find out what personality tended to fit you for the profession. It will be no surprise she found that really successful surgeons tend to have a certain, she thought, this is what she read into their Rorschach responses and whatever else she used for testing. She thought that she had found that very successful surgeons were a touch on the sadistic side. They had repressed or rechanneled sadism as sort of a major force in their lives.
That's one useful
of the five or six professions that she studied was taxidermy.
Really?
And her conclusion about successful taxidermists was they are on the schizoid side.
On the schizoid
side. That stuffing animals and getting so involved with recreating those lives out of dead creatures was rather a schizophrenogenic or a schizoid kind of preoccupation.
Well, I don't know about schizoid so much, but I can admit that part of my first initial attraction to Akeley myself was his kind of, what was this dark romantic intrigue of his work? And it was a morbid curiosity. I think that the first story that I ever heard about him was about how he'd strangled a leopard with his bare hands, and that caught my attention. So maybe I have the same sensibilities that led me to want to write about him.
He is rather like, I suppose, all active taxidermists out there in the field getting specimens. They're rather like that major in the Vietnam War who said that to save the village, we had to destroy it. And apparently, Akeley quite regularly hunted and killed the animals that he was going to then preserve for general, eternal, significant
That's the first step of the process. I mean, if you're going to mount a dead animal, you have to kill it first.
Unless somebody's brought you their dead pet cat.
Which, and in that case, somebody else has killed it first. Yeah. The ironic thing about this entire story, or the I should say the paradoxical thing about it, is that Akeley, along with the scientists who worked for the natural history museums, were keenly aware and quite worried about the imminent extinctions as they saw it taking place in Africa. This takes place during the scramble for Africa, the habitat loss, and the killing of wildlife there
by
was immense.
By the big game hunters, a number of whom he met, one of them being Theodore Roosevelt.
True. They actually traveled together. Akeley persuaded Roosevelt to come to Africa in 1910.
Yeah.
But the reason they were over there killing them in the first place wasn't just to make neat-looking art. I mean, they felt, and this is the interesting philosophy of the time, they felt that these marvelous species, these elephants and giraffes and rhinoceros, and animals that we felt like we had barely just discovered, or at least the Westerners had, were about to vanish. And so they felt the only thing they had to capture at least an image of these animals was taxidermy. It'd been the most high-fidelity form of capturing images of these animals. And so, yes, they felt, well, we'll have to kill a few first to bring them back. You know, the paradox in the end, though, is that Akeley had a change of heart. He had an epiphany, and he realized in 1921, while he was collecting, hunting mountain gorillas in the Congo, he realized that he truly felt like a murderer and kind of questioned, what am I doing? You know, maybe there's a better way than this. And he then set about persuading the Belgian government, who saw over the colony in the Congo, and convinced them to create the first wildlife sanctuary in Africa. Mm-hmm. So Akeley does get credit in the end for saving the mountain gorilla.
And a number of such sanctuaries still persist, of course.
Yes, yes. This was the very first one, though. So it's interesting that a taxidermist whose whole job had been to go over and kill all these animals was the one to realize that maybe we need to do something to actually save the animals' lives rather than just an image of these interesting-looking animals.
Well, apparently he was much more than a taxidermist, so that must have been the way he basically defined his mission. But he was clearly a significant photographer. Indeed, he made some technical contributions to the art of the machinery of movie photography, did he not?
Enormously so. Yeah. I mean, he basically reinvented the motion picture camera.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. I mean, he brought it along with him on these expeditions as a tool to try and make better taxidermy, because mm-hmm. he wanted to have these very accurate measurements with which he could go home to his studio and resurrect these dead animals as accurately as possible. And so he had the motion picture camera. But the one he had, it was very cumbersome. It wasn't very accurate. It was basically like a wooden suitcase mounted to a tripod, and he couldn't track anything. He couldn't keep it in focus. And then during World War I, when his expeditions were put on hiatus, in his spare time, he basically reinvented the motion picture camera to make it more nimble. He created the gyroscopic joint for the tripod to the camera, so it invented a much more fluent panning and way of following animals or anything you wanted.
He dies in 1926, having been born in 1864. So it's a pre-modern life in a way. Mm-hmm. I wonder how he would respond. He would have been quite pleased, I should think, of the efforts of a number of women, particularly Jane Goodall, in living with gorillas and in fighting to preserve their existence as a species.
Absolutely. And I mean, Diane Fossey, who ended up protecting the mountain gorillas and who died doing that, I mean, she gave Akeley credit for saying that, you know.
She was on that very site, wasn't she?
That very
site.
In the
Congo, yeah.
Yes, yes. And if it hadn't been for Akeley, I mean, Diane Fossey would not have had anything left to mm-hmm. protect, you know. I mean, Sigourney Weaver would never have been nominated for an Academy mm-hmm. Award for Gorillas in the Mist.
She wouldn't have found those gorillas in the mist again.
They would just be missed.
The man himself, we haven't really talked about the life that led to these achievements. Let's go back to 1864, the last year of the Civil War. Where is he born?
He was born in a small farming town in New York called Clarendon, which is about 20 miles from Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
His father was a farmer, but had a very hard time of it, and actually paid another man to go fight in his place during the war. And that was something that I think Akeley felt his father never got over, and his mother basically never let his father forget it. His father very much wanted to go west and try a better life, but the mother wanted to stay closer to home. Her family, the Gliddens, who invented barbed wire, were doing quite well, so her sisters were wealthy, and she wanted to be close to the family, but she also kind of tied the family there. So there was a lot of bitterness. Akeley, when I read correspondence between himself and his brother, there was a lot of bitterness about their mother. But I'm not a psychologist, so I tried not to make too many assumptions.
What shapes his interest? What in his early life seems to stand out as factors or forces pushing him in the direction that he took?
Well, taxidermy kind of it seems to be the first thing. I mean, he spent a lot of time alone. He was definitely a bit of a loner. He spent a lot of time wandering around in the woods, looking at animals, not hunting them so much. But then he started collecting them and performing taxidermy in his house, in his bedroom. He took over his bedroom. And his family was not extremely thrilled with this. You know, he had dead animals in various states of disassembly all over his bedroom, and I'm sure it smelled pretty awful. And he had all of the necessary ingredients, including arsenic, you know, in his bedroom that he could get from the local Bishop's drugstore. And he had found a taxidermist manual for sale in a magazine called Youth's Companion, and he'd purchased that for $1. He had one aunt in particular who insisted. She felt that his morbid preoccupation with taxidermy was severe enough that they might want to put him into an insane asylum, which was rather extreme. But then I think she changed her tune when she had her own pet canary died, and then she forgot to put the drape over its cage one particularly cold night, and then Akeley was able to resurrect it in his manner, and she was pretty happy with that.
How long does he hang out on the farm? Where does he go once he leaves?
He splits as soon as possible. He goes and he works for an interior decorator at the time, named Bruce, I forget his last name, but he was in Brockport. And this was when there was kind of a natural history craze. And so the well-heeled citizens of Brockport were very, they all wanted murals of birds and foxes and terraria and things like that. And so he worked for this man for a while, but Akeley really wanted to focus more on the taxidermy. He wasn't so good at the rest of the interior decorator business. And so this first mentor of his recommended that he go to Rochester and work for a place called Ward's Natural History Establishment. I think I've got the name right. That was the Ivy League for taxidermists and young naturalists. A number of different directors and presidents who would end up working for the Natural History Museums came through there. And they produced not only the taxidermy and the dioramas and things that were going into these new Natural History Museums, but also, gem collections and fossils and things like that. So he learned a lot there, but that's where he was still frustrated with the level of the art that he found there. And that's where he began to make some of his innovations. And his first,
you've got a scene in the book where somehow he's working for somebody or other, just handling dead birds and peeling the skins off dead birds forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was his purgatory. He'd been fired from Ward's for a while.
Yeah.
He was devastated by this. He was fired because he was found sleeping on the skins in the skin room up in the attic. Because he'd actually been spending his nights up working on his experiments. He was trying to take the skins off of animals with less visible seams and whatnot. Anyway, he was found sleeping on the job for whatever reason, and so he was quickly fired, and then he ended up in Brooklyn for a while working in a chop shop. Because at that time, the height of ladies' fashions were these hats with mm-hmm. with parts of birds or wings or entire birds on the hats, and so you know they had hunters who would go and hunt birds in the rookeries all day and come in with just sackload after sackload of every conceivable bird, and there would literally be a mountain of birds on the table, and it was an assembly line.
It does indeed
line.
Sound like purgatory,
doesn't it?
How did he get out?
he finally managed to persuade his old boss that he had not to come back to Rochester, which he did, and then he was quickly sent on what would be quite an assignment that would lead to his first great claim to fame, which was to mount the slain corpse of P.T. Barnum's legendary Jumbo the Elephant after he was in a head-on collision with an elephant.
One might very well ask, as if in a vaudeville routine, how do you stuff an elephant? And I'll ask you to respond to that right after we negotiate a brief pause. And we return to conversation with Jay Kirk. Drawing from a fine new book, I haven't even given its title more than once, if at all, Kingdom Under Glass, subtitle A Tale of Obsession, Adventure, and One Man's Quest to Preserve the World's Great Animals. That is just recently published by Henry Holt. That one man, of course, is Carl Akeley. But we're at the point where he's stuffing his first elephant, so to speak. Yes. How do you do that?
How do you do that, indeed? Well, I think it's funny that when he was stuffing Jumbo the elephant, that, you know, considering how obsessed and rigorous Akeley was later in his career with the idea of this kind of hyper-realism and the accuracy in recreating the animals, he wanted it to be just very, very realistic. But when he was asked to do Jumbo, P.T. Barnum himself actually asked, is it possible to stretch it out a little bit bigger? I mean, as if Jumbo wasn't already the biggest elephant known. But he did, and Akeley just sort of shrugged and said, okay, and stretched it out. And then P.T. Barnum actually had Jumbo continue to lead, you know, his circus, followed by
the stuffed Jumbo,
the corpse of Jumbo, yeah. Mounted. He had his own, even in death, as in life, he had his own palace car.
Uh-huh.
And he had a little, his widow, Alice, this elephant that wore a black hat and a black veil, went alongside him in these parades. But
some listeners, perhaps younger ones, may not quite catch on who P.T. Barnum was. How this fits into another great life story.
P.T. Barnum, I think, he was the greatest showman on earth. You know, he had the three ring circus and the trains and the Elastic Man and
his name still lasts in Barnum and Bailey Circus.
Barnum and Bailey Circus, yeah. Right? Exactly.
In a way, he made a great contribution to facilitating the further growth of the art of taxidermy.
P.T. Barnum did.
Yeah.
Yes, he did.
By hiring Akeley.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of solidified Akeley's reputation. And then he ended up moving on to Milwaukee, where he worked with his good friend William Wheeler, who was the director of that museum at the very young age of 21, and gave Akeley a great amount of leeway. And Wheeler, his buddy Wheeler, was very intellectual and I think could be said to be responsible for giving Akeley some of the bigger ideas behind what he would later get credit for actually implementing in his diorama, such as ecology and these new ideas in science that Akeley would make visible in his habitat dioramas.
Does the art of the diorama or the construction of an imitative habitat for animals caught and murdered in the wild, is that an art that is still pursued, or is that rather representative of a period, but the period is now gone?
There's so much better ways, of course, of looking at nature now. I mean, we have wonderful movie cameras that can mm-hmm. do that. And so, no. I mean, natural history museums, by and large, are getting rid of their diorama collections. You know, some people lament this because they have their own value. They're interesting. Some people think they're merely kind of an un-PC artifact that we could do without. I mean, the Smithsonian has largely gotten rid of their collection. I know the Natural History Museum in London is also divesting itself of their
dioramas. But his great venue was the American Museum of Natural History mm-hmm. in New York City, which you and I visited as schoolchildren, apparently. Have they maintained all of the halls there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I don't think they would never.
They're famous for them.
They're famous for them. And I mean, they are truly remarkable. I mean, I don't think they would ever consider getting rid of them any more than the Field Museum still has a wonderful mm-hmm. collection of dioramas, some of which are Akeley's early masterpieces. I think they're, you know, I mean, even I think with a grain of salt, when you go and you look at them, I mean, they can have a profound effect on the viewer. It's not really like anything else that you can look yeah. at.
Let's turn to Akeley the Explorer, Akeley in Africa. He was on some five or six major expeditions.
Yes.
In his life.
Yes. Yeah, his first was for the Field Museum in Chicago. Mm-hmm. That was in 1896. They went to Somaliland. Mm-hmm. They really had no idea what they were doing and got themselves into all sorts of trouble. It's amazing they survived it, actually. But probably the most notable thing that happened to Akeley there was one day he was out hunting ostriches, and he kind of shot mindlessly into the grass, and he heard this loud yowl of a cat. He figured that out quickly. And then he was attacked by a leopard. And in the end, after this long, very long struggle, he strangled it with his bare hands, which gave him a lot of street cred, so to speak. It was quite an interesting reputation to come home and say, I strangled a leopard with my bare hands.
What do we see of his work at the field today?
At the field, well, there's the two fighting bull elephants, which are in the Grand Hall, mm-hmm. which you cannot miss. He shot one of those, and his wife, Mickey, shot the other. And they're called the fighting bulls, and in a way, it's probably a foreshadowing of their marriage down the road.
She left him for a monkey, as I remember.
She left him for a monkey, that's true.
That needs explanation, which we'll get to in a bit.
But. Well, there's a number of Akeley's works at the Field Museum, but the other one that's really worth noting is the Four Seasons, which is one of his most early revolutionary pieces, where he did basically a suite of dioramas. There's four dioramas, and in each one is a family of white-tailed deer, and they're each set in each different season, and they're phenomenal, and he worked on them for nearly a decade, and it's not just Carl. I mean, almost everything is Carl and Mickey, and Mickey in this case I think created something along the order of 20,000 or 30,000 handmade leaves, using this little wax mold system that she did.
So let us come to Mickey. Let's come to the troubled marriage and family life.
The trouble probably began one afternoon. They were sitting around this. They were having lunch, I think, on safari on the Tana River, and they were debating the morality of keeping monkeys in captivity. And I think they were talking about zoos, and they were talking about monkeys specifically. And the men believed that monkeys were filthy little beasts that didn't deserve our pity. And Mickey was making the case that they were only filthy and unkempt when they lived in captivity because they'd lost their morale. And she set out to prove her point by then going and capturing a little vervet monkey. She brought it back to camp, and her intention was to keep it for a few days, show that it did not like the state of captivity, and then set it free. But immediately she fell in love with it, and she gave it a name, J.T. Jr., naming it after J.T. McCutcheon, who was one of their safari companions and who was a famous cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune back then. It quickly became sort of a wedge in their marriage, a little strain. Carl often found himself unwelcome in her tent at night, and she said that the monkey would get cold without her. And that also she was justifying her captivity. She was justifying keeping J.T. Jr. by saying that she was conducting scientific observations, and that at night it was important to be able to listen to the night sounds that it made so she could record that. She appointed one of the native porters to be J.T. Jr.'s personal valet, so who carried an umbrella around for the monkey all day, gave him a bath every night, and he pretty much had the rule of the camp. He could do no wrong. He did plenty of wrong, but Mickey let him get away with murder.
Did J.T. reciprocate her affection?
I think in Mickey's mind, she did, but back in New York, I mean, when they went back to New York, that's when things sort of really fell apart, and the tensions of this odd menage a trois came to mm-hmm. a head.
They had no children.
They had no children.
Yeah. They rather remind me of Keith and Kathy Hayes. Do you know those names?
No.
They were psychologists down at the Yerkes Ape Laboratories when they were still in Orange Park, Florida.
Okay.
And Keith and Kathy were very much interested in whether you could humanize a chimpanzee, or how far you could go in humanizing a chimpanzee. And they adopted a little brand new chimp when it was only about a month old and raised it as their daughter. So it was, she was Vicky Hayes, Keith and Kathy, and their daughter, Vicky, the chimpanzee.
Wasn't there one that they raised it side by side with their son as well?
No, that's the Kelloggs. Which
Kelloggs,
is,
right.
Which
okay.
is even earlier, Donald Kellogg. Vicky was the only child in the marriage. Mm-hmm. And they all got along famously for a few years. And Vicky acquired a comprehension vocabulary, supposedly, of 150 words. And she supposedly could utter two or three words. I met her once when they came to give a colloquium at the University of Michigan, where I was getting my doctorate. And Vicky spoke, said, mama, and said, wop, which was translated as cup, and so on. But still, they were interesting. They wrote a book about it, The Ape in Our House.
That's fascinating.
And then Vicky died of tuberculosis, as sometimes happens with apes in captivity. And there, unlike the case for the Akeleys, the death of the child broke up their marriage. She was so important to both of them that after her death, things just went very poorly and they divorced.
Well, that happens often in, if a human child is lost. That
true enough.
Frequently.
True enough.
Yeah. That's interesting. Mickey thought that JT Jr. could speak English for a while, too.
Uh-huh.
And she wrote about it in this amazing, one of her books, one of the two books she had published called JT Jr., A Biography of an African Monkey. And details him speaking. I mean, it seemed like the main word was yes. I don't think he moved much beyond
same
yes.
Same sort of deal, yeah.
Yeah.
For most of the larger portion of his senior career was spent at the museum in New York, was it?
Yes. He left the Field Museum to go work for the AM&H in 1908. So.
And he was there until the end of his life in 26.
Yes.
And he was for a while the president, I think, of the Explorers Society.
Yeah, the Explorers Club in New York.
Explorers Club.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So he was much honored.
Very much so. Oh, very much so. Yeah. I mean, he was considered. I think he was you know, as obsessive as he could be, and maybe even brutal sometimes. He was a deeply beloved and admired man, and he helped a lot of people. And to a degree, he was kind of selfless. He didn't go to. He frequently had friends who were trying to convince him to, like, Carl, you have to patent this method, you know, before someone else takes it. And he's like, I don't care. He just wanted to move on with the work and. He didn't think about a lot of those things. But.
At the Museum of Natural History in New York at the time that he was there, there were a number of anthropologists of considerable import. He must have overlapped Franz Boas.
Oh, yes, he did.
And Ruth Benedict and Margaret Mead and that whole bunch. What was the interaction between them?
I don't have any idea. I don't ever remember reading anything with those particular individuals. He overlapped with a lot of interesting characters with those people specifically. I don't actually know. I know Franz Boas and his boss, Henry Fairfield Osborne, got along horribly. You know, and that's more to do with Osborne's ideas about eugenics, which he was trying to expound upon, which Franz Boas rightfully thought was utter nonsense.
Yeah, and you write about that in the book. It's a racist or racialist sort of conception of eugenics, and somehow there was a connection between what Akeley was commissioned to do and what Osborne and some of his colleagues had in mind with regard to maintaining the purity of the race.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly want to be very forward in saying that I don't think Akeley had nothing to do with that. I don't think it was even part of his thinking. I never read anything where I thought Akeley was even.
But you suggest it was part of their interest to somehow foster their cause by commissioning Akeley.
I think what's very obvious is that a lot of the people who were the trustees of the American Museum of Natural History at the time were the oligarchs. They were the ruling class. They were aristocrats.
J.P. Morgan types and so on.
J.P. Morgan was a trustee, the Fricks, the Rockefellers, Osborne's, the Roosevelts. Roosevelt himself held some of these ideas about the terror of racial, you know, miscegenation.
Which Roosevelt?
Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy, not Franklin D.
Teddy Roosevelt, yeah. He was no more a fan of the melting pot than Henry Fairfield Osborne. But I think Osborne himself specifically was terrified at this idea of, you know, these teeming hordes of aliens coming to the southern tip of his island and possibly miscegenating with his fine Aryan racial plasm. I think that was the term that he used. And so there was this sense that I found that it was a metaphor that they were trying to preserve themselves. And there, you know, if you think about the compartmentalization of one diorama from the next and how one species shouldn't be
mixed
with
another.
It was each species
in its own place, so to speak.
Yeah, the bureaucracy of the species.
And that was a metaphor for different human types, they felt.
Yes, yeah, Osborne did. I mean, he did have a few exhibits that were deliberately, you know, they were under the idea of hygiene or public mm-hmm. health, and hoping that people would come into the museum and it would be a moral lesson, like don't mix with the wrong kind, keep to your own kind, that sort of thing.
It was a great preoccupation of that social class in those days, and it begins even earlier. Henry Adams, grandson of mm-hmm. presidents. Grandson and great-grandson of American presidents and a great historian conveys that very same concern about the teeming masses who are despoiling the actual inheritance and the actual racial purity mm-hmm. of the true American.
Yeah, this idea of degeneracy that we weakened it by, which is obviously borne out to not be the case. And I think Osborne is probably a great embarrassment historically to mm-hmm. the museum.
Akeley ends life a little bit too soon and because of trouble in Africa, doesn't he?
He does. I'd hate to give away too much. I don't know. But yeah, he had a fairly unpleasant end there in the Congo. I think in ways he you know, the exact cause of his death remains somewhat of a mystery. No doubt in part it was contributed to by just how hard he worked. I think he was working himself to death.
And he had a second wife who was helping to sort of redeem life for him, but it didn't last very long because he died.
Yeah, they hadn't been married for that long. Mary Job, who came along, but she, you know, she continued. She remained a great advocate for his work and the cause, and I think has to be given a great deal of credit for making sure that the dioramas and his vision went on and actually...
You've been a freelance... nonfiction writer for lots of the best museum, the best magazines, I meant to say. What this is your first book as such.
Yes.
After much magazine writing, what drew you to this man and this topic?
I was working on a story for Harper's Magazine about a natural history mystery. That's what it was. One day I was talking to my dad, who lives in north central Pennsylvania, and he told me how he had seen a cougar. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then he started kind of telling me how, he was like, you know, but it's kind of hush-hush, and you don't want to tell the game department because they'll just look at you screwy. And he made it sound very conspiratorial, and it wasn't anything I'd ever heard about. I mean, of course, I'd heard about cougars, and they have so many different names, a cougar, a puma, mountain lion. Catamounts, they had so many different names because at one point they used to be the most predominant large mammal in North America. But in the eastern United States, they went extinct in 1888. They were systematically wiped out. They were considered an evil just in the same way that wolves and coyotes were. And so they were wiped out. They went extinct in the East. And yet I kept hearing, I looked into it a little bit more, and I found out about all these sightings of mountain lions and these sort of cryptozoological organizations who were dedicated to proving that to tracking these sightings and looking for these sightings. And so I ended up writing about it for Harper's, and I spent quite a long time hunting around Appalachian mountainsides with amateur cougar hunters and tying cameras to trees and things like this, and also talking to the professional biologists.
Did you ever find a cougar?
No, not in the wild.
No.
Not in the wild. But it was, you know, it was while I was working on that story that I was reading about the history of, you know, our relationship to the wilderness in the West, and read something in passing about Carl Akeley, the famous taxidermist who had once famously strangled a leopard with his bare hands. And right away I thought, oh, maybe there's a book idea there.
There is a book idea. Indeed, it's produced a fascinating book, very expertly wrought by a fine journeyman nonfiction writer, Jay Kirk. By the way, that's spelled K-I-R-K, just as in Captain Kirk. And the title of the book is Kingdom Under Glass, a tale of obsession, adventure, and one man's quest to preserve the world's great animals. Henry Holt, the publishers, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.